I guess most of us think of Jesus as to some measure a warm, attractive, trustworthy. Whether we follow him or not, we still instinctively tend to put him among the good people. In fact, if we're not careful, we can get one-dimensional about him. It's something of a shock to pick up a biography like this eyewitness account of John's and read of a far more sinister figure than we usually imagine. Not so much part of the establishment as a threat to the establishment. I mean, it's interesting that the little Bible heading given here is Jesus arrested. Clearly not the work of a headline writer with a story to sell. They would go for at least terror suspect held. You know, they'd want to conjure up pictures of early morning raids, armed police, jackhammers through front doors. Well, John will tell of a late night raid. But you don't even need a few beers with the sergeant to fill in on the details John supplies. Nothing sensational here, just a factual account, but any investigative reporter is going to quickly be able to fill in the details and add the colour. It's the story of the prisoner under arrest. And John tells it very simply and clearly, and yet it's easy to see what the authorities were up to and what they were thinking. They'd been plotting for a while to take Jesus out. The police, the temple police, were driving it, but they wanted backup, so they turned to the military. And at festival times like this was, bank holiday weekends, they always moved the soldiers up from the coast to the barracks at Fortress Antonia, so they were on standby in Jerusalem itself in case celebrations got riotous. Well, this Jesus was heading something of a populist movement. He could certainly draw the crowds, and any arrest could easily turn ugly. This seems to have been very hasty and last minute, but the police had a grasp, an informant, Judas, one of Jesus' inner circle, and he said he knew just where to find Jesus. Some little garden across the Kidron Valley, a meeting place the group would frequently use, apparently. A kind of quiet, out-of-the-way spot that wouldn't be ideal to make an arrest. So the police picked up a detachment of soldiers, made their way through the city, picked their way through the remains of a few late-night Passover parties to the quiet of the valley. These operations can be simple and easy, but they may not be. And it's best to prepare for the worst, so they brought torches and lanterns in case they landed up chasing the suspect across the hillside, and plenty of weaponry just to be on the safe side. As it turned out, they didn't need them. The arrest was pretty smooth, just a minor scuffle, no need for hospital treatment, no further arrests. The temple police were acting as the arresting officers, so they had Jesus taken to Annas's place. Now, he'd been high priest himself until the governor had deposed him, but actually he was really the head of a dynasty of high priests. And that year it was his son-in-law Caiaphas who held the post. Technically, Jesus would just have been helping police with their inquiries, as they say. But it was clear even at this stage that it was all going to go a lot further than that. They had Jesus marked as trouble. And they'd make sure Caiaphas's prophecy about it being good for one man to die for the nation would be fulfilled. Life would be a lot simpler without Jesus. The prisoner under arrest. That's the basic storyline John tells in these verses here. Only the soldiers, the police, the high priest even, are not actually the central characters in his story. There's another script that's being followed. And John's cut back on a lot of details other biographers have included, details other gospel writers fill in about Jesus and his friends to highlight his big point. And it's a striking one. The prisoner under arrest is actually the prisoner in control. I mean, look. It's obvious who's got the power. We know who's got the muscle, the numbers, the weapons. But look who's in control. Very striking. From the moment the arresting detachment reached the garden. Look at the first pointer. What I call, what do you want? Verses 4 to 8. See, verse 4. Jesus, knowing all that was going to happen to him, knowing all that was going to happen to him, he is not naive. He is not out of his depth. He's not caught up in political intrigue that was too much for him. You know, people love to trot out those threadbare lines, don't they? There's no basis for them. Things are not escalating out of his control. He has the real script. He knows exactly where it's taking him. Jesus, knowing all that was going to happen to him, went out. It seems to have been some kind of walled garden. And as no doubt the troops plan to sort of deploy and cover the rear, he just steps out the front gate. Jesus, knowing all that was going to happen to him, went out and asked them, "Who is it you want?" "Jesus of Nazareth," they replied. "I am he," Jesus said. See, all those soldiers, torches, weapons. And Jesus just steps out the front gate and steps into their hands. Who's in control? I mean, certainly not Judas. You see, he gets mentioned there in verse 5, and Judas the traitor was standing there with him, the indispensable traitor, the one man who could identify Jesus for them, and he's left standing there like a lemon. Redundant. Jesus had done the job for him. Jesus has gone on the front foot, and everyone else is on the back foot. Look at verse 6. When Jesus said, "I am he," they drew back and fell to the ground. Now, John doesn't tell us why. What was it? Was it the mention of "I am," the personal name of Almighty God? Or just that gap between an arrest that was simple enough in theory back in the barracks, but now not so easy in practice? I mean, to lay hands on someone with a list as long as your arm of miraculous powers on his CV, now stepping confidently towards them. Well, verse 7, again he asked them, "Who is it you want?" "Jesus of Nazareth," they said. And Jesus answered, "I told you, I am he." Yeah, he has to give them another chance. As if he has the script, they must follow. As if he knows the script that shapes his destiny, the scriptures that tell of Messiah and what he had to face to rescue his people. And you see, all the forces are lining up together against him, aren't they? There's the personal treachery of Judas. There's the religious corruption of the temple police. There's the political ruthlessness of the Roman soldiers. Easter, which all of this is leading to, is not one more skirmish in the endless conflict of good v evil, light v darkness. This is the battle that guarantees the result of all future encounters, and Jesus steps forward into it. Who's in control? Or take the second step. What I call let them go, verses 8 and 9. See, look down at verse 8. "If you are looking for me, then let these men go." Jesus is concerned for his friends, is right at the front of his mind, so he demands safe passage for the disciples. Jesus draws the enemy fire to free them. It's what he'll go on doing all the way to the cross. You remember that Jesus had said once when he was teaching those around him, he talked about the good shepherd and how the good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. He'd spoken about the hireling runs away when the wolf comes, but the good shepherd remains. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep, and it wasn't just talk. He walks the walk. This is our Messiah's heart. One writer puts it this way, that caring heart is our security. Because of it, he will not lose one of those the Father has given. The good shepherd has committed himself to his sheep. When the wolf comes, he will remain and defend the flock he loves. Whatever the wolf may represent in our lives today, guilt and shame from past failures, the accusing voices of criticism, sudden paralyzing feelings of inadequacy, as they come snapping and snarling at our heels, the Good Shepherd is there to meet them and to issue his word of command, "Let my disciple go." Let these men go. Verse 9, this happened so that the words he had spoken would be fulfilled. I have not lost one of those you gave me. Do you get it? This clumsy, clunky, arresting group. Their minds full of overkill. But their size 10 hobnailed boots are only going to trample where Jesus' script allows. Who's in control? Or take a last little look. I've called "Shall I Not Drink the Cup?" verses 10 and 11. Because the soldiers aren't the only ones who can be clunky and clumsy. That isn't restricted to Jesus' enemies. It can be his friends as well. So look at verse 10. Then Simon Peter, who had a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant, cutting off his right ear. The servant's name was Malchus. The other Gospels all mention the incident. And Luke tells that Jesus healed the ear as he touched it. But only John names the individuals. You wonder if by the time he's writing, Malchus has reached some prominence or even perhaps been converted himself and is now part of the church. But Peter? Well, as you read, I don't know what you make of Peter. He's brave but clueless, isn't he? I mean, huge courage to come out swinging in defense of Jesus and against hopeless odds. But it's misdirected bravery. And that's a dangerous thing. It's always been a dangerous thing throughout history. He gets it as wrong in the garden as he will do in the courtyard later that evening when the servant girl, you remember, quizzes him about whether he's one of Jesus' disciples. He's no wiser now than when he declared Jesus to be the Christ, the Son of the living God, and immediately protested when Jesus talked about how he, Jesus, must be killed. Because that didn't fit Peter's ideas of a Messiah. Wasn't how he imagined God's King would rescue. And it still doesn't fit. It still wasn't how he imagined. Who's in control? Not Jesus' friends and disciples. The penny hasn't dropped for them yet. Only Jesus is still following the script. Look at verse 11. Jesus commanded Peter, "Put your sword away." I wonder how many times down history he's wanted to repeat that to his friends and disciples. "Put your sword away. Shall I not drink the cup the Father has given me?" Bruce Milne writes this, "The cup," he says, "is the symbol of the judgment of God. It is the cup of the wrath of God against human sin." See, as we read the Bible, we discover not just that we're sinful, but that sin matters. Someone has to drink that cup. And Milne goes on, "In the strange mercy of God, the cup of his righteous wrath is given into the hands not of his enemies, but of his beloved Son. And he will drink it down to the dregs until the moment comes when I thirst gives place to it is finished. Caiaphas spoke truer than he knew when he said it would be good if one man died for the people, but his was just a cynical, callous political calculation. This Messiah would do just that out of loving self-sacrifice. Shall I not drink the cup? I mean, Jesus knew the script. One man does die for the people. He's going to fulfill the Old Testament prophecies of God's Messiah. Shall I not drink the cup the Father has given me? It's as if John knows of Jesus' agonies in the garden. You remember when they're praying in the Garden of Gethsemane? Well, Jesus is praying, the disciples keep falling asleep. And there's anguish cries, if it be possible, take this cup from me. Nevertheless, Father, not my will, but yours be done. John knows of it. He just shows us the result, the fruit of the agony. Shall I not drink the cup the Father's given me? Jesus willingly embracing the Father's outrageous plan to deal with the people's sin and reaching out to pay the cost himself. Shall I not drink the cup? Who's in control? I told the other day of a brutal machete attack, which left a victim 1.5 arms short. She'd just been walking home, and the assailant sprang out from behind a hedge and viciously mutilated her. And they were talking with her afterwards, after she would begun to recover and they'd healed the wounds and so on. And as she was sort of berating herself for allowing it to happen, someone said to her, look, if you'd known he was lurking there behind the hedge, you wouldn't have gone home that way, would you? Of course not, she said. But Jesus did know what was waiting for him. And he still went through with it. Shall I not drink the cup? Who's in control? What price will he pay for us? See, as we join in communion in a few minutes' time, we are saying thank you, Jesus, that you knew what was coming and you drank the cup, you went to the cross, you took the judgment for sin that should have been mine. Look, if you want to look respectable, if you want to look moral, don't eat the bread and drink the wine. They're not for you. They're for people who are saying, I'm a wretched sinner, I can't even save myself. If you're one of those who want to be able to face God on your merits and stand on your own 2 feet before him, don't eat the bread and drink the wine this evening. They are not for you. They're for those who know their sins, know their matter, know their lack of merit and their need of mercy, know the desperate need of a Messiah who'll drink the cup of God's wrath for us. The bread and the wine are for those who look with awe on the Jesus who says, shall I not drink the cup? Who marvel that he should do that for you. Do that for me. That he would drink the cup of God's judgment so I never need to. You eat and drink only if you're saying thank you to the Jesus who did that. Shall we take a moment to reflect before we go on?